Just 2 cents an egg, farmers say small increases are urgently needed to save family farms. Running to stand still, October energy hikes gobble up €600 energy credits. And 61 years on, a thalidomide mother is still waiting for the state to say sorry. Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. Joining us in studio today, we have Charlie McConnellogue, Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Padraig Tobin, Leader of Aonthu and TD for Meath West, and Marion Harkin, Independent TD for Sligo Leitrim, is in our Sligo studio. And later in the programme, we'll be joined by Fianna Fáil MEP Billy Kelleher. We want to hear from you as well, so get in touch. Email saturday@rte.ie, text us on 51551, or you can tweet to @SaturdayRTE. Now, Minister McConnellogue, you've dashed up to us from the RDS, from your Ardesh there. What's the mood like?
Yeah, the mood is very good among the membership, I think, or members from right across the country are glad to be able to come together again to reflect on the last couple of years in government and the challenges that's been there and how the party has worked within government to support the public and to underpin the economy, but really importantly to try and make progress in relation to public services. And also reflecting on the budget last week, where again we put in place support for people for what is going to be a challenging few months ahead. And I suppose it's 11 years, I'm 11 years a TD now, it's the first time that I've attended an Ardesh with Fianna Fáil being in government. So that's really, you know, when you look at our membership from across the country, they're very practical people. They're people that are involved in their communities. They're people that want to make a difference and to deal with the challenges that are there as best we can. And very much, you know, energised by the opportunity to come together and discuss where we're at and also plan how we can support communities and support the public over the time ahead.
And talking of those challenges, I know the Taoiseach has been out today and has been talking about plans for housing policy and basically saying we're sticking with the plan. The plan is the plan and that's what we have. But when you look at those figures on homelessness that were published yesterday evening, like a record high, 3,220 children in emergency accommodation as we speak, 10,805 adults altogether people in emergency accommodation, and August marking the eighth consecutive month where numbers accessing emergency accommodation are increasing. Like, when you're seeing that many people coming into the system at one end, it's going to be impossible to get on top of it unless other emergency levers are pulled. Would you not agree?
It's not acceptable that we have that homeless situation and so many families and people who don't have a permanent home. And it is the number one priority for the government to work to address that. And as the Taoiseach says, the policy we have in place, Housing for All, is absolutely comprehensive in relation to putting in place all of the levers that are necessary to actually address the situation. But while there's many reasons that contribute to homelessness, Katie, the one solution to it is supply. And the government are doing absolutely everything in our power to drive that on and to deliver that supply. It can't happen quick enough. And the government are doing all we can to push it and obviously to increase the capacity that is there. And if you look at the progress that has been made, we're up to 25,000 houses being built this year. And we now have the highest level of planning permissions and commencement since 2008. And then across the various schemes that are in place, particularly, for example, the Croí Cónaithe scheme, which Minister O'Brien announced, which is paying up to €50,000 of a grant to bring vacant and derelict properties, both in towns, villages and in the countryside, back into play. We have a comprehensive suite of policy, but the key thing is actually seeing that deliver
Targets, and I think it's been acknowledged now, and I know that it's been well reported that Cabinet Subcommittee on Housing have been warned that you're going to miss the targets. Those targets are not being met and won't be met. But even if you were to meet them, when you are bleeding people into the system at the rate we are now doing, with increases month on month, and we're now at this figure of 3,320 children in emergency accommodation, like, if that's not setting every alarm bell going in government buildings, like, what figure would trigger an emergency response, would actually get the government to reconsider those emergency levers like a rent freeze, like the ban on evictions that we had during the COVID period?
Well, I think every lever that we can use that's going to contribute to addressing the situation is being used.
I just mentioned two levers that are not being used.
And we've brought in rent freezes also there's constitutional and other issues in relation to eviction bans. But the key point here, Katie, is that there isn't enough homes in the country To be able to provide a home for everyone. And we need to improve supply. But hold on, Pádraig. And that is the key objective of the government. And every lever that we can use is being used to do that, whether it's helping people to actually purchase their home, get a deposit together for it, plus helping renters now with the challenges that are there for them.
Or indeed, you have outlined your policy very well.
Helping people in terms of homelessness challenges there at the moment as well, while we increase supply.
I think it's important to look at the human cost of this, first of all. Over 100 people die in homelessness in Dublin alone every single year. And the government doesn't even record the amount of people who die in homelessness in the rest of the counties. And while, you know, we have about 10,500 people currently in homelessness or emergency accommodation, there's at least another million people who are in housing distress, either in rents that are unaffordable or trying to buy a house or on housing waiting lists as well. Just in the last budget, you'd imagine there would be an urgent response to this. Yet, the government's plans on a vacant site tax or a residentially zoned tax, that's still in the future tense, which is an incredible issue. On the issue of vacant home taxes, the government have a very nebulous plan there where they say that a person has to be in the house for over 31 days. How is that going to be policed? Do people take selfies in the house for 31 days to prove that they've been in the house? Nothing concrete, nothing like implementable now in relation to those two very simple steps. And then a third issue, the government introduces a levy on concrete in a housing crisis. Now, you have to be fiercely detached from the housing crisis to think that putting a further cost on actually building houses is a good idea in a housing crisis. It's just mind-boggling.
Well, I know you'll want to come in on that, Minister, because that's something that's very close to your constituents in terms of the mic issue. But I want to bring in Marion Harkin from our Sligo studio. In relation to those emergency measures like the ban on evictions and rent freeze, and I know opposition have been calling for those, but the downside to that, of course, is that it may frighten more people away from the rental market.
Well, I suppose the first thing I'd say, Katie, it's I was coming in, I was listening to the news about the Fianna Fáil Ardéis, and I heard somebody mention that they wanted a Donna O'Malley moment. Well, if ever there was to be such a moment, it would have to be about housing. And what I felt about the budget was that it under-delivered on that particular issue. I mean, I agree fully with Pádraig about the vacant site tax, the vacant home tax, the concrete levy. I mean, those were issues, the first two, that needed to be pushed. And then the third one, whoever thought about that in the current circumstances needs to think again. Now, there are some good things there. The Croí Cónaithe scheme and the fact that that has been now rolled out to rural areas should deliver. Absolutely should. But 2 points I would make. I spoke with Simon Northwest. They're a homeless charity and they help to keep people out of homelessness in this region. And of course, Simon nationally do so as well. I met them last week in the Dáil. They still don't know, and today is the 1st of October, what their funding is for next year. When people find themselves on the brink, Simon, one of the organisations that they call, people who understand the system, people who will listen, people who will support them. No, but this is really important for people who find themselves in that situation. And the other point I would make, Katie, is that at the end of the day, building a house in itself isn't always the most difficult thing. The most difficult thing is to have the planning in place, to have service sites, to have water, wastewater services, all of that in place. I want to hear from government that that is being done so that in 6 and 9 months' time, those houses can be built.
Okay. Minister, do you want to just respond in particular about the concrete levy, which was probably the most controversial measure in a budget, even though it was referring to an 80 million euro tax take, but it caused probably the most controversy.
Well, what I'd say first of all, in relation to the government having a comprehensive approach to this, we have the only comprehensive plan to addressing the housing crisis that we have, the only one. While everyone will be able to identify where the challenges are at the moment, we have the only plan in place, and it addresses all of the challenges that are necessary in relation to increasing supply. And we're putting unprecedented investment. So we have the largest ever social housing funded programme ever in the history of the state in place, because it is absolutely needed.
Okay.
unfortunately, you can't do it overnight, Katie. And if we
Simon
could,
Phil Hogan, Simon Hogan, Owen Murphy, and now Darragh O'Brien have said it can't be done overnight.
Okay, let the minister respond.
Excuse me, Patter. So we've come from a situation where housing, a new housing development had was at a level of 7,000 or 8,000 per year, to where it is now at 25,000 per year and growing. The government is building that up towards 40,000 as quickly as we possibly can. And ultimately, that is the solution to the homelessness problem and to the housing challenge.
Do you think we'll be talking about Darragh O'Brien like we now talk about Donna O'Malley?
Absolutely not, because when you look at the Housing for All strategy, which is the only strategy that's been published by any of the political parties, it is comprehensive and it is being delivered upon. And the supply is increasing year on year.
Okay,
now,
alongside that, we
have put in place, whether it is the Help to Buy programme, the affordable housing programme, or indeed the rental supports in place to help ordinary people as well to actually avail of housing. But key to it all is supply, and that is the government's number one priority.
Okay, I want to move on to your own brief, Minister. Because in his opening remarks to the Ardesh last night, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, he singled you out for mention. He promised that there would be a future for farming families. And yet, as we're speaking here today, farming families are protesting outside a supermarket in Cavan Town. Egg producers, pig farmers, protesting about the price they are getting for their produce at the point of retail. Before coming on air, I spoke to two of them, beginning with Gary Pepper, a pig farmer from Coothill. And I began by asking him how much money he's losing at the moment.
Oh, look, it's dreadful. It's going on now, probably, as we were saying, over 400 days of this now. You're heading on 14 months of losing money. I sell 1,200 pigs a month, so it was 50, 60,000 a month I was losing, so like it was horrendous. I don't mind taking the pain sometime. You know, you have to with pigs, you know, it's supply and demand, and you have to take the good with the bad. But just it's going on now for so long. There's only me and four staff, so like a relatively small farm to be losing such a lot of money. Although there's loads of money in the system. Like the end product is still, like, no, it's just we're not getting a fair share. Like 12%, that's what we get of the end product that's been sold in the shop. That's wrong, like, and we're getting left with nothing. So like that's there is loads of money in the system. It doesn't have to go up to the person buying it, the customer. Like,
what kind of an increase would you need to, you know, make a decent 20%, profit?
Like 20% is like we've got 20% of the end product. It's huge to us. And we got support from the government already, and that, like, we got 100,000. We got that, and that's brilliant. And it's such a huge help and such a relief, because boys were just going out of their minds trying to wonder how they're going to pay for feed and get feed for pigs. But like I said, I probably lost between 350 and 400,000. Because I said, even if we got 10 cents a kilo now, that would get us to fit to pay all your bills. If I could get out, I would. It's just, you're buried in that deep in debt. And it's such a slow system. Like, if I stop serving sows now, I'll still be selling pigs for the next 9 months.
And would a food ombudsman, would that make the difference, do you think?
You need someone there to regulate it. Nobody's just having someone there as an exercise to say that they are, that has to have the clout, like, or no one takes them serious.
My husband's a poultry farmer. We have a farm here with laying hens. I might support him and the other farmers, not just the egg farmers, the chicken men and the pig men. I feel like it's all I can do is to go out and stand with them and be supportive. And not just myself, our four children as well, after school, I've been out the last two evenings, standing out and talking to customers and explaining why we're there. And personally, the last year is gradually getting worse and worse with the price increases and all this that's going on. It's increasingly stressful, and it's a support to him, because I know he's feeling it this last year especially.
What age are your children, Samantha?
Our oldest is 12 and our youngest is turning 9. We have four children. I pick them up from school, get something to eat, and then they go out and they stand in at the protest. Yeah, they've been talking to people and meeting the other farmers, and they want to be there for their daddy. And, you know, they know that it's been tough because they're here as well at the farm, and they're helping out as much as they can, maybe more so than they should be, because at their age they should be playing and having fun and doing stuff that kids do, but they're spending their mornings, especially at the weekends, over picking eggs and trying to help out. Brennan's dad, my husband, his dad is 77. He's working there all day, every day, 7 days a week as well, alongside Brendan. And we're over there at the weekends, and when the kids are off in school, we're over helping just to try and ease the burden. And
so what would make the difference for you? What are you asking, or what would you like to see coming from the retailers now?
All they're asking is for 2 cents an egg. Like, it's a small ask. Like, I know times are tough for everybody, and they're probably thinking, oh, you know, everything's going up, but it's going up for us as well. Like, and I'm a customer as well as a farmer's wife, and I know that the price of everything is going up.
And I know, of course, everyone will have heard this debate going on for years now about the margins that farmers are getting from supermarkets. And we've heard that the minister is going to move, and there have been talk about a food ombudsman or maybe some sort of a watered down version of that. Would that make the difference, do you think, for you?
It would help. It definitely. It'll keep, like, we're working at a loss, and it's not sustainable. Like, we're actually closing one of our hen houses because we can't afford to keep it open. If somebody had the power to you know go in and, you know, look at it from all angles and see who needs what and police it a bit, because at the minute I don't think there's any kind of policing of it.
We'll have the minister in studio, the agriculture minister Charlie McConnell, yeah, Logan, in studio today. What would you say to him, you know, as you know, somebody there in a farming family in Cavan?
Well, I have to remember that the farmer is the guy that's producing the food and putting in the work and doing all the stuff, like, you know, looking after the animals, looking after the farm, looking after, making sure they're fed, making sure there's food for to be sent to the supermarkets. Like, they're like my husband there, he's up in the morning and he's gone at 7 o'clock and he's not back maybe till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. He deserves to be paid for what he does, and he's working for near nothing. And then aside from that, he's not getting to spend time with his wife and his children. We miss him. We don't have a life with him. It's really hard. It's hard on him. I worry about him. And now, looking at all the other men and people that are standing outside at the supermarket, I worry for them now as well, because what kind of future is there for farming if this is the way they're being treated? You know, we're just, like, they're on their knees. They need help. My husband hasn't stopped working. He works every day. It's 365 days a year. It's even Christmas Day. He's out. He just, this is the break we need. We need 2 cents an egg. That's all we're asking for.
That was Samantha Riley there, who is an egg producer from Cavan. Minister, you can hear there in Samantha's voice and other, these people are at breaking point. You were up in Cavan, I believe, on Thursday for a government event. Did you meet with the protesters at that?
I didn't meet the protesters, but I've met representatives of all sectors right through over the last number of weeks and months. And Samantha's absolutely right. Farmers deserve to be paid for the work that they do, and they need to be paid for the work that they do.
And they need to be paid more. And they need to be paid.
They need to be paid a proper income and proper representation for the work that they do. And that's essential, that the retail chain is responsive to that. It's been a challenging number of months for family farms because of the particular impact in relation to the war in Ukraine and what happened in relation to feed costs, energy costs, which were particularly challenging for the agricultural sector, and also fertiliser costs. So you spoke to Gary there at the start, for example, in relation to the pig sector. I moved to support the pig sector this year. I delivered 2 packages specifically for them. As Gary himself said, just in the last 3 weeks, I've delivered up to €100,000 per individual pig farm to help to support them. Likewise with the horticulture sector this past year, and also then for beef and sheep farms in relation to the fodder support, the €1,000 for making fodder last year, which is again going to be there this year. But bottom line is that while government can support, we need a responsive food supply chain whereby if there is increased pressure from a cost point of view on primary producers and family farms, that needs to be immediately responded to in relation to the rest of the supply chain. And that's why I've published the legislation in relation to the new Office for Fairness and Transparency.
Can we just talk about that? Because, yes, you know, there was, you know, you were promoting this in opposition very strongly. Mm-hmm. This was going to be the holy grail. This was going to deal with this. But hasn't it moved so far away from what was originally proposed now? The office now won't have the status of ombudsman or of a regulator. It won't have the power to investigate retailers' pricing policies. It won't have the power to mediate disputes. We're now talking about an office of transparency that just shines a light, I think was the phrase you used when you spoke about this recently. Do we not have enough light on this? No. We need somebody with power to actually intervene.
It will have power, and it will have the power to enforce unfair trading practices, and there will be the capacity there to fine and indeed to bring prosecution where they are being breached. But it's essential that we actually have a statutory office for the first time ever. And you're right, this is something that I was very strong on in opposition. Eamon O'Queeve, who was a spokesperson before me, as well.
Would you accept that this has now met reality and you've been told you can't do what you thought you could do in opposition?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. I'm delivering on what we proposed that we would, and I'm calling it because it's not an ombudsman, because what we actually need is an active participant in the retail supply chain here that actually works between the various layers.
Works between the various layers in the actual supply chain and actually brings about
fairness and transparency.
It's heartbreaking
to
listen to Samantha's view there, but it's not uncommon, and it's happening right through the agricultural sector right now. Chagas reckon that only 37% of farmers are actually making a living off the farm. Another 30% of farmers are only surviving because somebody else is working off the farm, and a full 30% of farmers in this country are actually losing money and going into debt. And every year there's less farmers in this country than the year before. We have a dysfunctional agricultural market. We have a supply chain where we have the farmers, sometimes a factory, and at the end we have a supermarket. It's very profitable, but all the profit is landing in the last two elements of the supply chain. The farmers have been squeezed more and more. In economic terms, it's called an oligopoly. The buyer, the supermarkets and the factories have massive...
The minister has just said he's moving on this.
Listen, the minister's not moving on this, because I actually attended an agricultural committee where the minister attended and the former chair of that committee attended. We brought in a bill which was called the Equitable Beef Price Bill, which looked to put a floor under the price of beef so it couldn't be bought for below the price of production. Both the minister and the previous Fine Gael chair said it was unreasonable to legislate that a farmer should always receive a price above the cost of production. So that shows you the mentality of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael with regards to farmers.
Okay, I'll let you back in. I just need to let Marion in. Marion.
Yes, I heard what the minister said, but the Agriculture Committee has done a report on this and they've given it to the minister. And what I would say to the minister is he needs to implement what's in that report, because throughout part of my time in the European Parliament, we dealt with this unfair trading practices directive. But what you need is you need a food ombudsman, a food regulator with teeth. This isn't just about ticking a box. This is about stopping those in a dominant position from abusing their power in the food chain. As you said, shining a light on it is not enough. The food ombudsman has to have that power. And I mean, I know a little bit about poultry production, because at one point I represented Cavan Monaghan, etc. And one of the things I can tell you is that poultry and egg production are heat and energy intensive. I mean, the cost to those poultry producers because of the rise in energy prices is hugely significant.
Can I just ask you, Marion, though? I mean, and this is a very sensitive issue because of the cost of living crisis we all find ourselves in. Should retailers, should householders who want to have eggs for their breakfast, should they pay 2 cents more for those eggs?
What we're saying is, Katie, there should be a fair distribution of profits in the system. And there seems to be little doubt that in certain parts of that system, and we're not talking about the primary producer. I will answer your question. We're not talking here about the farmer, the primary producer. In other sectors, whether it's the processor, the distributor, the retailer, that there's more significant profit there. It's a bit like the price gouging with the energy companies. The idea here is that nobody gets to make a major profit. This is a food chain. And yes, to answer your question, it may mean at the end of the day that there may be a slight increase in price. But equally, Katie, it might mean that there isn't, because this is about fairness in the food chain. It's not about pushing up prices.
Can I just briefly come in at that point?
I need the minister to respond. Minister.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, people have talked for many, many years, decades, Katie, in relation to what we can do to actually improve fairness in the food supply chain and ensure that farm families get properly paid for what they're doing. As a government now, we are actually moving in that and bringing in an office which actually will deal with and oversee that.
Could the ultimate outcome of this be that it is acknowledged that we are selling food too cheaply, that we cannot sustain this in the long term, that farming families cannot survive because there isn't enough profit for anybody in the system.
The bottom line is farm families need to be paid for the work that they're doing. It is the smaller percentage
who
of the overall...
Who needs to pay that price? Is it consumers or the retailers?
It is the smaller percentage of the overall end price, but farmers must be paid properly. And if that means a smaller increase at the end, then if you're to have a sustainable food supply chain, then that is what is required. But what we need is right throughout the supply chain, clarity in relation to where the margins are, ultimately with the objective of making sure that farmers and farm families get the fair play they deserve. Because what happens too often is families are always the one, and the primary producer is always the one that is getting squeezed in relation to the margin.
We've had this conversation.
Not other levels.
Well, I think everyone agrees with that. So.
And that is why we're bringing in a statutory office, which actually
very briefly, we've had this conversation exactly the same 5 years ago. There is no need for any increase to the consumer at all. Many of these factories are making billions of euros of profits. Many of these supermarkets are making billions of euros of profits. They're squeezing the profit out of the farmer. The farmer can get a bigger price any increase
consumer. I just want to read what a statement from Aldi, because that protest has been outside the Aldi supermarket there in Cavan. They say they're hugely frustrated and disappointed at this protest, hugely frustrated at these developments as they undermine the current ongoing discussions with our suppliers. As always, Aldi is committed to working with and supporting all of our Irish suppliers. We paid higher prices to egg suppliers in June of this year, which represented the largest increases we have ever agreed, while we are fully engaged in the most recent round of discussions. And they say that they look to support all their suppliers while continuing to shield our customers from price increases as much as possible during this current inflationary period. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave it there. Minister McConnellogue, many thanks for joining us. I know you have to get back to the Ardesh, but we'll take a break.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And we're joined in studio now by another Fianna Fáil representative, MEP Billy Keller. You're very welcome. And still with us, our ANTHU leader, Padraig Tobin, and Independent TD, Marion Harkin, who is in our Sligo studio. Well, I don't know what the mood at the Fianna Fáil Ardesh has been like, Billy, but... the mood around the country won't be helped today with that front page of the Irish Independent this morning saying that those increases that we got in the budget, the energy credits we got in the budget, the €600, will all be gobbled up by the increases that are going to come our way in October right across the board from the energy companies. So is there a sense down at that Ardesh that of what's coming? And if this continues at this pace, that there will have to be further help in terms of energy bills in the new year?
Yes, well, I mean, the government hasn't ruled that out. I mean, they did bring forward credits for energy bills in the budget itself, 200 this side of Christmas and then 400 in the new year. But there is no doubt across the entire European Union, across the world, energy prices are really escalating. It is causing significant problems to businesses, but into households too. So, I mean, if we don't see an unwinding of the link between gas and electricity being the benchmark price, well, then we're going to have a significant problem in terms of electricity costs into the future. And that's one of the big issues that has to be decided across Europe in the next number of weeks.
OK, tell me about those announcements in relation to windfall tax and price caps that came out of Brussels overnight. So agreement has been reached. We're told that Eamon Ryan, our own minister, saying that between 1 and 2 billion euro could be raised between a windfall tax and a cap on the price of energy from non-fossil fuel sources like nuclear and renewable. Can I just ask you about that in terms of the price cap? Because obviously the government here has set their face against capping energy generally. But we have a lot of renewable generation in our mix. So does this open the door to a price cap on that source?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Irish market is slightly complex because there is already a cap in some places with regard to renewables because they're in a contract price already. So they may not be able to put their price up because they're obligated to deliver it into the grid at a certain price. But taking the European energy and electricity market as a whole, there is no doubt that, you know, if we continue as we are, where renewables are making extraordinary amounts of profit at the moment, you know, wind, solar, nuclear, hydro are making extraordinary amounts of profits. We need to cap that. we need to drive that down to, they're talking about 180 euros per megawatt hour. That needs to be done. And the other thing then that I welcome, we've been calling for some time in the European Parliament, was a windfall tax on coal, oil and gas suppliers that are making extraordinary profits. And that's where we see where we should be able to get money directly to households, you know, in terms of supports through the exchequer to households and businesses.
So the price cap, you say, we have to introduce it. We have to introduce some form of price cap.
I certainly has to be a price cap for electricity from the renewable sector. From the renewable sector now, not from those.
And are they charging beyond what the that
well,
cap?
Some in Ireland, some aren't because they're obligated to
but
provide.
Some are. That,
some are getting the gas price.
Some are getting the gas price because they would be outside of contract at this stage. Well, a lot of
renewables who are currently getting the price as if they were, you know, having to have an input of gas. You're saying that
they should be capped. Yes.
Will they be capped?
I believe they will be. Yes, I think they should be. Well, I mean, like the European Union is proposing it, and you know, the Irish government is obligated, in my view, to follow that course of action to ensure that we've uniformity across the European Union
and,
with regard to price caps.
And I'll go to you in a minute, but I just wanted to get your view then on the windfall tax. At what level? Because it seems to be very loosey-goosey, like between 1 and 2 billion. There's a lot of space between 1 and 2 billion euro if we're talking about what we might get in on. Where do you think that levy should be?
Well, there is, Katie, because we simply don't know where gas prices will be in the short and medium term. We know where they are now. We know how much they are over and above what they were over the last...
Where would you like to see the levy set?
What I'd like to see it set as in advance of the madness that happened from, we say, June onwards. You know, you had the invasion, you had a spike, but we've had a complete failure in the market in the sense that gas now, the dearest component in electricity, is setting the benchmark price for electricity across the entire European Union. So we need to have that windfall tax, but we eventually have to break the link between gas and electricity.
So the problem I have with the electricity credits was, first of all, we are paying more in fuel taxes today than we were before the actual energy crisis started, which is unforgivable that would happen. 80% of the electricity credit that people are getting is actually the extra tax we're paid back to them in relation to the fuel tax. It's unforgivable the carbon tax went up as well. The issue, I agree with Billy in terms of the decoupling of gas-generated electricity from the rest. But the problem I have with this is you're leaving it for the European Union to do it. The Irish government could do it right now if they wanted. Spain and Portugal have done so. And also with the windfall tax, again, it's the European Union are going to do it, yet Italy did it. It reminds me of Homer Simpson when he was running for mayor. He used the slogan, "Why can't somebody else do it?" This government is responsible to our people to do this work. We shouldn't be waiting for the European Union to do these simple steps.
Can I let Marion harken in, then I'll let you back in, Billy Keller. Marion.
Well, I mean, obviously we're waiting to hear overnight what decisions were made at European level. And in my view, a windfall tax is absolutely essential on coal, oil, gas. What money will be raised? I heard Eamon Ryan say 1 to 2 billion, and as you said, that's pretty wishy-washy. But that, of course, depends on the price of gas. But I think, in all honesty, Katie, most of us feel at this stage that things are not going to improve for a considerable length of time. Now, whether that's 3 months, 6 months, I don't know. But the, you know, even in the last 24, 48 hours, what is happening, we see that everything is being ratcheted up. And people, you know, in listening to this programme today in their homes, their fears are being ratcheted up. And they know that unless their government protects them, unless there is some sort of a cap, then they just know that they won't be able to pay their bills. I mean, Pather spoke about the electricity credits there for households. And while they will help, already today we hear they're going to be eaten up. I know the government has left it open, but one of the things that I absolutely couldn't understand was why at least two of those were not paid before Christmas. We're looking at one 200 euro energy credit before Christmas, Katie. It's useless. At the very minimum two, and probably all three, should have been paid. And at least that would give people some sense that they wouldn't be looking at bills that they couldn't pay. And similarly with businesses, Katie.
Yeah. Okay, Billy Keller, very quickly.
Well, look, I mean, the government has said that in the event of the electricity prices, gas prices continuing to spiral, that they will stand by the people. But I mean, in the context of this budget, I mean, there has been an announcement made that there will be a 200 euro credit paid immediately and two more credits of €200 each in the new year. And there's an acknowledgement, I think, by everybody that the government can't just continue to follow the full inflationary pressures that are out there.
But is it the case, as Padraig says, that 400 of that 600 is actually just our own increases in VAT and
well, look, I mean, when fuel prices go up, there's an excise increase. That is a mathematical fact. Yes, yeah. There is. But, I mean, at the same time, that money is going to provide service to
VAT. Why don't we reduce VAT on diesel, petrol and kerosene in the same way that Spain did it?
Because the government has decided to give a €200 credit. And let's be very honest.
Why take the money off people and give it back with another hand? That doesn't make sense.
But in fairness, this is a direct payment, direct to families to deal with electricity bills, Padraig. And that in itself is a very significant intervention. It will not alleviate all the pressures, but it is a significant intervention.
I'm watching the clock. I'm watching the clock. And I just want to ask Billy Keller, while I have him in front of me, the LNG. The Green Party has set its stall against that terminal in North Kerry. What about floating terminals? Where is Fianna Fáil on this now? Because Fine Gael have come out strongly in favour of it.
Well, look, I'm very much in favour of us diversifying our dependence on the UK gas market. We effectively have one pipeline coming from Scotland into Northern Ireland. That's where our entire gas comes from, the UK.
LNG.
And then the Corrib. Yeah, so LNG, in my view, will be of significant contribution to countries in terms of diversification from Russian gas and also...
Not this country, because we don't have any storage at all.
Exactly, we have no storage. And we have no capacity, even if we import it, we have no capacity to regasify it into the system. So my view is that the LNG should be supported. It's not necessarily the one in Tarbert. I'm not touting for the Tarbert one specifically. I think it should have gone ahead already. But we do need to have LNG. Otherwise, we are hostages to all the markets.
OK, that's it. I have to take my break.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Now, on Tuesday, RTÉ Television's Scannel programme will feature the story of Ireland's thalidomide survivors. There are just 40 of them still living. 61 years on from the withdrawal of the drug, those survivors are still waiting for an apology from the state. Most of their mothers died without ever officially being told what happened was not their fault. Peggy Murphy is one of just five of these mothers who are still with us. Now 93, she spoke to me before we came on air about why she took thalidomide when she was pregnant with her son Martin. The year was 1961, Peggy, and this was your third pregnancy. You were obviously very sick through it, were you?
I was, yeah.
You went to the doctor and what did he say to you?
Oh, he said that he'd a very good tablet and that he'd give it to me. So he wrote out a prescription for 24 of these tablets. When I took it to the chemist, she said by the time you'd have them paid for, she said, you'll forget about your sickness. So I said, why? So she said, they're a shilling each. Give me half of them. I said, they'll do.
So you had no idea that there was anything wrong then until Martin was born?
The nurses or the doctors, anyone didn't tell me. It was my husband told me.
And what was Martin's disability?
He's missing his ear and he has facial paralysis and his eye is affected.
But you didn't know at that point that it was had any connection with those tablets?
No, not an idea. No, it was. There were a lot of deformed babies being born in England at the time.
And did you know about that?
I didn't. I didn't know for 3 or 4 years.
When did you finally realise what had happened?
There were a lot of deformed babies being born at the time and the doctors, they were got suspicious, and Dr. Brendan Corse was the Minister for Health at the time, and Dr. John O'Connell, and they came together and they formed a sort of a council, and they investigated into it, and they brought over two German doctors, and we all had to go up to be tested by these doctors.
And do you remember that? Do you remember going to Dublin for that?
I remember it well. I got a telegram on a Sunday to be up to Dublin for 3 o'clock Monday. There were hundreds there. And the doctor, he only just looked at him and he said, typical, he said, of the thalidomide.
Typical of the thalidomide.
That's what he said. I'll always remember it. I was devastated. I feel so sorry for him. His life was taken completely from him. And it's very sad that he can't connect with us.
And how is he now, Peggy?
He's fine. He's a man now, but he's fine. But he gets bouts of depression.
When you say he can't connect with you, is that because he was deaf? He was deaf from birth?
Oh, he's deaf. He's deaf and dumb.
And have you been able to get help for him over the years?
Not really. Well, now he was in school in Dublin from 6 to 16, I think.
That must have been hard, was it?
It was desperate. I'll never forget the day I took him up. It was horrific. And he roared and he cried, God love us.
When you say you were, it was devastating to find out that it was those 12 tablets that you took that brought this about. Was it because you felt responsible then?
Well, I trusted my doctor. I didn't know what to think. I mean, I didn't feel responsible. It was my doctor's fault or it was the government's fault that it wasn't tested.
Like, over the years, have you been waiting for somebody to acknowledge all of this?
Yeah, I cannot understand why they won't give us an apology.
Is that really all you want, Peggy?
Well, I want a fair financial money for him because... if his health deteriorates or if he has to go into a home or anything.
You're worried about him?
Yeah, I'll be worried about him. I'll go to my grave.
You're not a spring chicken yourself at this stage?
I'm not. I'm 93.
And you've been minding him all these years?
I mind him all these years.
So you want to have to make sure that there's funds in place,
yeah,
that he'll be taken care of when you're not there?
Yeah, and an apology.
An apology for him and an apology for yourself.
Exactly. The tablet was never tested. And I mean, that was a dreadful mistake in the government's part. It was the worst thing that could happen in the medical history.
Peggy, there's only 4 other mothers still alive that we know of.
Oh, is that all?
So for yourself and for the other 4 mothers who were put through this, what do you want to say to the government now?
I want an apology immediately. I think it is very unfair the way they treated us down through the years. They didn't even want to know about it.
But you don't want to go to your grave without getting that apology, yeah, without somebody telling you it wasn't your fault.
My time is running out now and it wasn't my fault. I think it was a desperate scandal. Every day I look at him, I feel so sorry for him. Like his life was stolen.
And that was Peggy Murphy there from Cork, talking about her son Martin. I'm joined on the line now also by Finola Cassidy, who is a thalidomide survivor herself and a spokesperson for the Irish Thalidomide Association. Finola, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Katie.
You feel a special responsibility to Peggy and the other surviving mothers.
Katie, that was absolutely heartbreaking to listen to Peggy, and I suppose, being that there's such this tiny cohort of them left, we all as a little group, we've really adopted them. Our love and affection for them is boundless because, you know, we see what happened over the last few years, and there's Peggy able to tell her story. But in many cases, a lot of us are struck by those personal moments that we have with our mothers, where in some cases they did try to explain what happened and try to nearly apologise to us, which was completely not necessary and not the right thing to do. And then in some cases, it was never mentioned, but it came out in other ways, with the upset and the stress and the guilt. And the mother's health was affected considerably. And I think the survivors, my fellow friends listening to this, we will be very upset to hear Peggy, because it brings it all back to us, what we went through with our mothers and what those mothers went through. It really is not their fault, and they have to be told this, and they have to be told this by somebody in authority, like a Taoiseach. They need to be receive that apology.
And as well as that apology, like what else are you campaigning for, and have you been campaigning for many years now, Finola?
Yeah, well, because the tragedy has now lasted 61 years, there is so many aspects to the tragedy that obviously we can't get into them today. But one of the other aspects that's very telling is that among the people we represent, there's probably about 12 survivors who have never been recognised by the state. They were needlessly affected, and mostly because their births were after the so-called official withdrawal date in 61. But of course, the Irish state never looked after a proper recall, and we know that drugs were available up to 1963. And what we have been trying to explain to the Minister and to the Department of Health is that the diagnosis of thalidomide has now moved on leaps and bounds over the years with genetics, etc. And those of our members who are yet to be acknowledged, who've never received a penny, they have, at huge cost to themselves, gone through a lot of medical reviews with world experts in thalidomide. And they have received an absolutely categorical diagnosis of their thalidomide deformities. And no more than what Peggy just explained there, in our cases, the rest of us who were acknowledged came to Dublin in the 70s to a horrendous ordeal of examination. So these people have gone through that, and they definitely need to be acknowledged now as part of the cohort of the Irish children who have now survived to 61, who deserve a deal to be done at last. As you know, we've been campaigning. You yourself had investigated many documents that shows the culpability of the state. And so if I was to summarise what we need to acknowledge the wrong. The state needs to acknowledge and accept its hand, act and part in the tragedy. And the Scannell documentary next Tuesday really covers that very well. And then the apology. The apology, obviously, to the mothers, but obviously to the likes of Martin as well, and myself and my other survivors, whose lives were completely affected unnecessarily. And then let's negotiate. Negotiate a fair compensation and a healthcare package that would see us into the last end of our lives, because we are all now in our 60s. And as I said, the bona fide cases of the unacknowledged, it is absolutely time.
Okay. I have to let you go there. Fionnuala Cassidy, many thanks for that. And just again to remind people, that Scannell programme on the thalidomide scandal will air on RT1 television and on the RT player on Tuesday next at 7 p.m. Billy Kelleher, this is such a small cohort of people. It's extraordinary, is it not, that they are still waiting for something as basic as an admission of liability and an apology?
Yes, Katie, just as a citizen, I mean, listening to Peggy, listening to Fionnuala, I've met with him as the Fianna Fáil spokesperson on health for some years, and I met with the Thalidomide Association frequently. It's hard to believe that we're still at this stage where we are discussing a scandal that happened 61 years ago, whereby, you know, a very small number of people who have had extraordinary impacts in their lives, both mothers and the survivors themselves. And I believe it's just time for the government just to make the decision. I know there'll be legal arguments and others. We just need to make a decision.
I know that the Thalidomide Association has met with the minister and with the Taoiseach.
They recently met with the Taoiseach. There's legal advice, all the rest of it. I just believe at this stage the government just has to walk in. It has to be brave on itself and just say, we apologise to the people and put in place a compensation package that recognises the impact of the 5 surviving mothers and the children of thalidomide damage.
I think there's clear wrong here. So the drug was removed in 61 in most other countries. It was 9 months later before it was removed in this state. And also there was no proper recall.
It was on the shelves in many bathrooms and in many GP surgeries.
Maybe up to 64 at least. So there's clear wrong here. I think what we're seeing is an example of the adversarial behaviour of the state towards people who have suffered wrong by the state. And we see that in the HSE at the steps of the Supreme Court.
I should mention it, because it didn't come up in the interview there, that the Thalidomide Association have been in the courts, have been stuck in the High Court for years and years now, and they're being denied. The state has been ordered to disclose documents, and the state is saying it's going to cost millions and millions and are refusing to disclose
documents. That's at the heart of this. And the state needs to get to a place where people can find redress for wrong that has been done to them without access to the courts. Because the courts, first of all, cost millions and cause major stress and strain on people who have suffered so much.
I just need to let Marion.
Just need to say we got it wrong. If you look at the US, for example, thalidomide was never placed on the market there because the Food and Drink Administration, a very famous lady who was checking out the drugs at the time, refused to allow it to be placed on the market. We got it wrong. The mistake was ours. And we see what has happened to those families since, to the mothers. It was so difficult to listen to Peggy. You know, do it, make the apology, put the supports in place. Yes, there may be legal arguments, legal difficulties, but they can always be circumvented. And those 12 unacknowledged thalidomide sufferers, they need to be brought into the system as well. Okay. This is a small thing to do, but it's a hugely important thing to do.
Okay. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks to my panel and to the Minister who was with us earlier. Sean Marin was our broadcast coordinator. Research was by Andrew Fleming. Dave Gibson was on sound, and the programme was produced by Regina Henley. Stay tuned now for the documentary on One.